Interview with Dr. Lawrence C. Goodwin, G-O-O-D-W-Y-N, Duke University, November 18, 1974. Interview by Jack Bass.
Go ahead. You said you have a couple of thoughts you'd like to offer at the beginning.
In 19, you can check the figures. Walter can check this for you. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson ran against Barry Goldwater. The same time that Ralph Yarborough is running for re-election, U.S. Senate, Yarborough has become increasingly identified in the eyes of his Texas constituency with a pro-civil rights position. And it becomes a major issue in the campaign. He's running against Gordon McClendon. There are a tier of counties bordering the Sabine River, which is the border between Louisiana and Texas. The percentages will vary from county to county and tend to get more conservative on the Texas side the further north one goes from the Gulf of Mexico, because as one gets further north, one gets into the area of the East Texas oil field, which is a very conservative area. But by and large, the counties on the Texas side of the Sabine River are voting for Ralph Yarborough. At the same time, Jack, that the counties on the Louisiana side are voting 2-1, 3-1, and 4-1 for Barry Goldwater. Now, these counties are exactly the same in terms of an agricultural base and the size of the county and that sort of thing. How does one explain this? I'm not sure it can be explained, but I have the following theory that since Texas became a state in the Jacksonian period, became a republic, acquired a political identity, got its domestic mythic hero, Sam Houston, the victor at San Jacinto. He became president of the Texas Republic, later became United States Senator. He was a Jacksonian nationalist. He voted for a bill to admit Oregon as a free territory. As I recall, he voted against the Kansas-Nebraska Compromise, that act. He performed, he committed a number of public acts in the Senate that identified himself with a national position as opposed to a pro-slavery position. In 1857, he came home from Congress to run for governor of Texas as an independent because he was afraid that forces of secessionists were taking control of the Democratic Party. He did not win. In 59, he ran again, a bitter campaign on the eve of the Civil War. His campaign was to hold Texas for the Union. He won that campaign. He was subsequently deposed for refusing to take an oath of loyalty to the Confederacy in 61. After that came the populist revolt. And at no time between 1865 and this election I've just referred to in 1964 was there not a presence in Texas, a living presence of a political entity generally associated with what we might call liberal values. The populists, a series of progressive governors, at least one in particular. Campbell, I believe his name is. I'll have to check it, but it's about 1907. Ferguson in the 20s, Jimmy Allred in the 30s, Ralph Yarborough in the 50s. This position did not always prevail, to say the least. That's not the point. The point is that it was always there. Now, insofar as a one-party structure diminishes the possibility of ideological division, such division can only be maintained, it seems to me, by word of mouth, generation upon generation, that there is a body of people in a small town who work, quote, for the people, unquote, for the candidates of the people, and that they pass on their organization. Now, if in any given generation there is no presence, political presence, of this representing this perspective, this tradition, which essentially is an oral tradition containing a political memory, dies. And I would suspect, although I don't know this to be true, that in most and conceivably all southern states, this tradition has been severed at least once between the Civil War and the present for a generation, so that this living memory is no longer there. And I think the explanation of the 1964 vote on the two sides of the Sabine River, to the extent those votes reveal a different political stance by people who in all other respects are the same, is traceable to this continuing presence of an alternative mode to the conservative democratic apparatus, represented by Sam Houston, the populist, Ferguson, Allred, and Yarbrough, and Rainey in the 40s. The Allred, Rainey, and Yarbrough. So that when Yarbrough, the beginning of modern Texas politics, I think, is probably the 52 campaign, when the Alan Shivers is leading the entire hierarchy of the Texas Democratic establishment in support of President Eisenhower, that is a national Republican. And the story goes, Ralph has told it many times, that he decided to run for Attorney General. He was a judge. And he met Alan Shivers on the steps of the Capitol and said, Governor, I want you to know I've decided to run for Attorney General. And Shivers purportedly said to Yarbrough, you can't do that, Ralph. I've already picked my Attorney General. And as Yarbrough tells the story, the manner in which this information, the imperious manner in which Shivers delivered this message, so outraged the good senator, the good judge, I should say, at that point, that he decided he'd run against Shivers. And he did, in 52. Now, that campaign took place in a Democratic primary prior to the decision, the public unveiling of the coalition between the Shivers Democrats and the National Republicans, so that Shivers did not have to bear that burden while campaigning against Yarbrough. And it was a 2-1, as I recall, 800,000 for Shivers, 400,000 for Yarbrough. But after that election, after the general election, Yarbrough then ran against Shivers in 54, accused him of Democratic Party disloyalty, accused him of being a Republican, of being the party of big business. He was counterattacked by the Shivers forces, Yarbrough was, as being the candidate of the ADA, AFL-CIO, NAACP. Now at that point, I don't think Ralph was any of those things. I think he came to accept support from those points of the compass because they voted for him. As Edelman argued that they voted for him because they were being used as bludgeons against Ralph. But it is by no means clear that Ralph Yarbrough was a conscious liberal in 1954. Now that was an incredible race in which at the end of the first primary there were three people in the race. Shivers got something like 690,000 votes. Yarbrough got 670,000 votes. And the other fellow got 25,000, just enough to throw it into a runoff, that is to deny Shivers an absolute majority. Well, that scared the death out of the Texas establishment, that here's this most popular and powerful conservative governor who was almost defeated by this Johnny-come-lately. And the runoff campaign was a violent one, rhetorically violent. You'll hear stories in Texas, and you should get them, about the full meaning of a documentary film that was made called The Port Arthur Story, which was about, which is a major campaign document of that period by the conservatives. And it opened with a scene of deserted streets in Port Arthur. Footage that was taken at dawn. I had a camera crew there for 3 or 4 days to get enough footage of completely deserted streets without passing bread trucks and things like that, that kind of messed it up. And then they opened the film with this, and the announcer came on and said, "This is Port Arthur, Texas. This is what happens when the CIO invades a Texas city." And it turned on a strike of retail clerks there and associated Yarborough with it, and there were black pickets, and there was a lot of racism involved, and it was just a race-baiting, anti-labor diatribe, and very effective, and played on statewide television. And that was just a violent campaign, and they both spent a great deal of money. Shiver spent an estimated $7 million, I think, which is a considerable amount of money for the governorship in that era. Shivers won the runoff. There were actually something like 100,000 more votes, you can get the exact figures, cast in the runoff than were cast in the primary, which is very unusual. So great was the interest. Now, in the course of that campaign, Yarborough predicted scandals because of what he called the corrupt Shivers gang. Well, lo and behold, the land scandals broke the next year. And it was evident that Shivers was discredited.
Where were the land scandals?
Well, Bascom Giles was a land commissioner, and Texas had a veterans land fund that had been created right after the war. Allowed people to buy land at low interest. And there'd been there were some scandals in the awarding of the manner in which tracts of land were approved for these loans and who got them and so forth. The Texas Observer played a key role in breaking all this. Now, incidentally, I did a paper at the Southern Historical Association on the Texas Observer in which I go into the formation, the background of the formation of the Observer, which grew out of the 54 campaign, that contains a number of
facts,
and you can get a copy of that, right? Now, the conservatives looked around and discovered, my God, Yarborough's going to win. We've got to get a horse to beat him. So they pulled out of the U.S. Senate the junior senator, Price Daniel, to run against Yarborough in 56. And Daniel, that's a two-pronged campaign that you ought to study because it has a lot of, there's a third candidate in there, Papio Daniel, who's a demagogue from the late 40s, early 40s, past the biscuits, Pappy. And in the first primary, the vote totals are roughly like this, 600,000 for Daniel, 400,000 for Yarborough, and 280,000 for O'Daniel. But the O'Daniel vote was almost wholly transferable to Yarborough, even though ideologically O'Daniel was very conservative. And the runoff was very close, and it is the considered opinion of most Yarborough leaders, and certainly of the senator himself, that election was stolen from him, and that they had to steal something like 25,000 votes that he actually wanted by that much. The official election return, as I recall, 694,000 for Daniel, 691,000 for Yarborough. I think 3,000 difference, so out of 1.5 million cast. That was 56. Well, the election of Price Daniel, when he had been the former U.S. Senator, now created a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. And Yarborough ran for that in a special election in 57 and won. He became the junior senator. Ran for re-election in 58 against a man named Cowboy Bill Blakely, the owner of, at that time, of Brana Fairways, an oil millionaire. Yarborough beat him decisively. Then ran for re-election in 64 against Gordon McClendon, another Dallas millionaire, the owner, the founder of the Liberty Network. He won that decisively in the midst of the Goldwater, the Johnson landslide. Then he ran in 70 for re-election a third time as defeated. Now, the polarization of Texas politics that occurred in those campaigns in 52, 54, 56, 57, 58, which Yarborough's name was on the ballot, created the basic constituencies that exist in Texas today. Now, there have been some changes in those constituencies. The liberal coalition has become, it used to be a rural populist, urban liberal minority group coalition. The rural component of that has gone down, the urban component has gone up, the black component has gone up, the Chicano component has gone up. They have not taken power. They have not won any elections. Sissy came close in 70, I guess it was, when she got 45% of the vote. That's the historical background.
And labor fits in that coalition?
Yes.
Okay, then what all right, now where did the role, what was the role of John Connally?
Well, in 1960, after Kennedy selected Johnson as vice president, and the thrust given to Southern liberalism by the presence of Kennedy in the White House, created a great opportunity. At that juncture, John Connally came home as Secretary of the Navy under Kennedy to run for governorship of Texas. The liberals didn't have a candidate. And one young man offered himself, Don Yarbrough, no relation to Ralph, would run for lieutenant governor in 1958 against an old establishment hack named Ben Ramsey. And Yarbrough had run a fairly good race, better than people expected, but he was defeated. He decided to run for governor against Connally. Now, this was really an interesting and decisive moment. The incumbent is Price Daniel, running for a third term. There were six major candidates in the field, five of them running on the, basically for the conservative vote. John Connally, Price Daniel, a railroad commissioner named Marshall Formby, who had certain oil and gas backing, and West Texas ranching backing. He was from West Texas. The Attorney General of the state, who was quite conservative, Will Wilson, who later got national, became a Republican and acquired a certain national notoriety in the Nixon administration, had to resign under pressure. And General Walker of Oxford, Mississippi frame, running for with the support of the John Birch Society. It was very clear to the young liberals in the state that Don Yarbrough was going to be in the runoff, because with one guy, even assuming that John Connally could cut into the liberal vote by using the Kennedy connection and by spending money in the black community and by chopping away at the right wing of the labor vote, making deals through Lyndon and so forth to get cooperation from certain labor leaders, that even with all those inroads, that there was enough liberal vote left over that when compared with the conservative vote being split five ways, that Yarbrough should be in the runoff. Well, he made the runoff. In fact, the incumbent governor ran third. John Connally ran first, Yarbrough ran second. And at that point, older liberals who had held back from the campaign because they thought Don Yarbrough was something of a charlatan came into the campaign. And that runoff was one of the most exciting political races I've ever been a part of. And I was Don Yarbrough's press secretary in that campaign. And we were closing the gap fast, and they knew it, we knew it. Even Tom Wicker came in the town the Monday before election and said the word in Washington is that Don Yarbrough might be closing fast enough to catch him. What do you think? I said, I think so, but I would feel better if we had until about next Tuesday instead of next Saturday. I just felt we hadn't peaked yet. And we lost that race by 10,000 votes, as I recall. Very, very close. And then, of course, Connally was shot with Kennedy, and that he became a martyr, and there was no hope of beating him, although Don Yarbrough foolishly ran against him in 64. The campaign I'm speaking about is a 62 campaign for the governorship of Texas. What Connally did, in effect, was to co-opt part of that Yarbrough coalition, the right wing of it, and Johnson had always had a certain clout. Johnson's basic power base was the Yarbrough coalition plus what he himself could add to it through his connections with big oil. And Connally broadened that base, cut into the liberals a little more, mobilized the conservatives, and became a figure in his own right. Now that had the effect of slightly changing the focus of conservatism, that is a public face of it, from the sort of heels in the ground reactionary politics of Alan Shivers to a slightly more flexible position. And then, as the 60s wore on and the liberal threat became more pronounced, the willingness of conservatives to placate labor, make certain accommodations with black leaders became more pronounced. And this had the effect of, in ways that aren't too substantive, but which are highly visible, to liberalize the ruling conservative regime. That in turn allowed liberals to be more liberal without laying themselves open to a racist attack.
There's nothing like anywhere else in the South comparable to that liberal wing in Texas Democratic
I don't think
Party,
so, no. Because it is very liberal. It's comparable to Northern liberalism in Minnesota or Michigan. Very liberal.
And you trace it all the way direct to the direct descendant of Sam Houston?
Well, I think you can do that. I mean, I'm not an authority on Texas history, and I just observed that we have this phenomenon of this tradition, and I observe also that it's always been there. It's always had at least one representative in each generation to keep it alive. Now, I've never written that. I don't think I've ever written that. So if you write it, you'll be the first. But
of course, you also have those Sabine River parishes in Louisiana. You still had that long tradition in Louisiana that should have provided. I'm throwing that out as a devil's advocate.
Well, but the long presence was not visible in that election of 64 that could be translatable.
This was after Jimmy Davis had just, I think Jimmy Davis was governor of Louisiana at that time, and it really tilted Louisiana politics far to the right, particularly in racial terms. Probably the most racist period in Louisiana.
Well, I think you ought to talk to Ralph Yarbrough, and you ought to tell him that Larry Goodman has a theory that Larry holds very tenuously. Larry speculates that this might be true, and ask him what he thinks. He says, and Don Frisco. Now, if I were you, I'd talk to all of these men first, and get their highly contradictory versions of what Texas politics is, and their characterizations of the respective sides. And then I'd go to a new moderate, like Armstrong, the Land Commission. And you'd now be armed, you see, with all the things that Connolly and Briscoe and Yarbrough and Sissy Farenthal have told you. And I think you'll get a somewhat different perspective from all of those. It'll be between those perspectives, you see, from a man like Armstrong, who's really trying to get votes from all those points of the compass.
What does he have his eyes on?
I don't know. But the Observer people should be able to tell you what they think. I think it's very important you talk to a man named Stuart Long, and that you take the time. Now, John Ford is an interesting man.
Who is John Ford?
Well, he used to be the Capitol correspondent.
End interview with Larry Goodwin. No more transcription. This tape.